You are tuned to Radio EcoShock's Summer Showcase. This week we are listening to a special online radio podcast called Legalize Freedom with Greg Moffat. Greg is interviewing UK journalist and carbon expert Mike Berners-Lee. The topic is the new book, The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal, and Gas, So How Do We Quit? Let's return to author Mike Berners-Lee as he talks with Greg Moffat about leaving half of all the fossil fuel resources in the ground.
And it's pretty clear that there are hundreds of millions of dollars have been pumped into creating confusion over what the science is, and propaganda, spurious skeptic propaganda, and misleading the whole world over what the over the climate change agenda. And that looks as though that's come from a part of the business community that sees a very obvious threat, because there are assets that may need writing off, will need writing off, and have responded to that. But what hasn't, I don't think, been adequately grasped is that actually there's a massive business opportunity out there as well. So there are plenty of businesses who have a strong commercial interest in pushing for a global deal on capping emissions. And I'll just explain a bit about where that comes from. So at the moment, if humankind wants to have more utility of anything, it's got two basic routes that it can go down in order to have more. It can either burn through more resources, just dig more fuel and other resources out of the ground to use them up, and then it can have more stuff and do more things and travel more and burn more energy and all the rest of it. And the other way of doing it is to become smarter and more efficient at creating things and doing things, and to innovate new ways of doing it. So at the moment, there are two ways of having more, and we tend to do a bit of both. We become more efficient, and we also burn through more resources. If we cap the resource that we use, then suddenly, if we want to maintain or grow our utility, there's only one way of doing it, and that is to become more efficient, or to become smarter, or to invent a new way of doing something. So if you are in the business of innovation and efficiency, let's say you're an ICT business or you're any number of businesses, actually a cap on fossil fuel use is a massive business opportunity potentially. And if you look at where the company value is going to go, if oil companies lose out by writing off some of their assets, then that shareholder value is going to shift to somewhere. So that opportunity that faces many, many businesses is a card that I don't even think it's been properly noticed yet. And it's certainly not a card that's been played properly yet. So there ought to be a big faction of the business community, at least, pushing hard for a global deal, even if it's purely for the sake of their own commercial interest.
Well, such action then, that would raise a huge question about the value of put on the oil industry and in the assets in the ground. And of course, we think about how important the energy industry, to the conventional energy industry, is to the world, not just in the ways we've been talking about, but from the point of view of investments, because they generate a lot of income streams for a lot of people that may not even realize they're benefiting from. It could be a pensioner sitting at in their front room somewhere in Croydon and not realize that a chunk of their pension investment is in Statoil or whatever, and that's how they get paid. And that could really be a game changer.
It's a good point that the vested interest in that, the value of that fossil fuel, is spread throughout, especially throughout the developed world. So, and it touches us all. So if you ever invest any money in anything, unless you're very, very careful about how you invest it, it's almost certainly going to have some fossil fuels tied up in it. And it's all our countries, and some more than others, though. So, yeah, it's very widely dispersed, the value in the fossil fuel. But don't forget, supposing you've invested in a pension fund and there's a portfolio behind that, the lost assets in the fossil fuel are going to shift to somewhere else. So that may well also be in your portfolio.
Now, I do very much agree with your earlier point about GDP and growth, these other metrics being used crudely to somehow measure our happiness, which they don't reflect. And I do think that the consumer culture that we live in the West, and actually increasingly in some of the emerging economies, is a big part of the problem. It's actually a psychological problem in a way that we invest our hopes for our happiness in, plasma screen TVs and cars and bigger houses. And we do this because we're basically working with faulty information, obsolete paradigms. Governments and media, of course, they perpetuate this in our minds. So it's kind of a vicious circle of delusion, basically.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they're only ever substitutes for the things that really make us happy most of the time. And that's right that we're locked into that mindset. And I think that's right that it's a cultural thing. And it's also propelled by a multi-billion pound industry that encourages us to think that way. So one of the things we talk about in the book is we have a little graphic of three carriages of a train, and one carriage is the extraction carriage, so that's all the fuel getting dredged up out of the ground, and attached to that is the combustion carriage, which is where the fuel gets burned, some of it in households, but a lot of it in industry in the course of making all the stuff that we buy. And then the final carriage is the consumption carriage. So you can attribute all the fossil fuel emissions or all the greenhouse gas emissions to human consumption. And if you add up the extraction, it turns out to be just about the same number as the figure you'd get if you added up all the combustion, and it's just about the same number you'd get if you added up the emissions attributed to human consumption. So all those three carriages travel at exactly the same speed. So if you try to put the brakes on the consumption carriage by encouraging people to have lower carbon lifestyles, for example, what you're up against is that the coupling with the combustion carriage is pretty strong. You've got all the businesses who are making their living out of creating enough stuff, as much stuff as they can, and persuading you to buy it. They're coupled to the consumption carriage through, you know, all the marketing and PR and advertising and all the rest of it that's encouraging you to think that you've got to have more stuff. And in turn, the businesses that are making all this stuff are coupled to the extraction carriage by the fossil fuel companies who have an interest in making sure that they sell their fossil fuel to somewhere and that that market is alive and healthy. So we actually need to work on all those things together. And in terms of the culture of consumption, the consumerist culture, I think one of the questions that I don't think we have a clear answer to is how much of the way we currently do life is fundamentally unfit for purpose and needs reinventing. And how much of it is fundamentally okay and it's fit for purpose, but we just need to make one or two structural changes and then carry on as before. So, for example, if we could bring about a global deal on fossil fuel extraction, then you could argue that we could still have a consumerist society and everyone could still be clamoring for as much stuff as they could get their hands on. And actually, it wouldn't matter in terms of the overall global environmental impact, because although one person's excessive consumption would deny somebody else maybe having enough, it wouldn't make any difference to the total carbon footprint of human consumption. So there's one argument would say, look, if we could just get the cap on emissions, then we could just let the consumerist culture carry on and do its own thing, and it'll be fine. But another argument says, actually, you'll never succeed in getting that cap without doing something about the consumer culture first, because we've got to bring about the conditions in which everybody's prepared to have the cap so that the politicians fight for it. And linked to that, there's another argument that says, actually, you know what? The consumer culture never made us happy anyway, so let's just ditch it. Let's ditch it anyway, and here's an opportunity to do so. And I think finding our way through that debate, I think we all have instincts about it. And I talk to people who think climate change is a big deal, but they don't really think we should tamper with the consumer culture much. And I also talk to people who have always believed that consumer culture is rotten at the core and has never really served us very well, and climate change just gives us one more good reason for ditching it. And that's probably, in my heart of hearts, that's probably where I come from in all this instinctively. But I don't think it's proven that we definitely need to reinvent the consumer culture in order to crack climate change.
So many mixed messages then, and contrary to what, you know, consumer culture, what business and advertising are telling us, there's the message which, you know, politicians will get up and completely counter their talk about growth, and depending on what the, you know, the purpose of their press conference is, and they will say that it is an imperative that we do something about climate change. It is the biggest threat that we're facing. But in your phrase in the book is there's just enough abstraction, complexity and long-term uncertainty around all of the science and other things, you know, connected to it, for us, you know, as humans, we like to do this just to push the problem off to another day, kick it into the long grass, and that they, as I mentioned earlier in quotes, somewhere down the line, technology, some genius, an Einstein type figure will, you know, it'll all get worked out in the end. Because after all, we've come through a lot of problems, you know, the last 10,000 years hasn't exactly been without tumult. So here we are. So the idea is that, you know, the march of progress, the myth of progress, it must be, you know, it must go on.
Yeah, I think that argument that we'll be okay because we've always been okay for the last 10,000 years is hilarious when you look at it, actually. Because, you know, what every species that has ever existed on the planet could say that about itself until the day when it came extinct. So it's actually a completely non, you know, there's no evidence whatsoever in the notion that we've always been okay so far. So that tells us nothing at all about whether we'll be okay through this. The psychology of human denial is fascinating and critically important. So we called our book The Burning Question and asked the burning question, how can we leave the fossil fuel in the ground? But perhaps the burning question, the real burning question behind the burning question at face value, is how on earth can humankind really wake up to this? I mean, it is a massive threat. It's clear it's a massive threat. And yet we're sleepwalking into it. I mean, all of us, even those of us who say we care about it, you know, who can really say that their own response to it is in keeping with the scale of the challenge we're up against? And it's precious few of us. So how can we wake up? The psychology of human denial is well documented, and it's a fairly well understood phenomenon that if a human being gets a bit of bad news, we go through a bit of a curve. It's sometimes described as a transition curve or a change curve, where the first thing we do is deny it, and then we get angry about it, and then we get depressed about it, and then we kind of sit down and come to terms with it, and we face up to the reality of the situation, and then finally, at that point, we can start picking up the pieces and working out what to do about things. And, you know, humans go through that process virtually every time they encounter a bit of bad news. So if you're driving a car along the motorway and you run out of petrol, you go through exactly that process in a short space of time. First of all, you don't believe it, so you stamp your foot up and down on the accelerator a bit to see if you can get any life out of the car, and then you maybe pull over in the hard shoulder and thump the steering wheel a few times because you got cross about it, and then you get all depressed and you sort of slump down in your seat and you just think how awful the world is, I can't believe this has happened to me. And then finally, you come to terms with it, and then you start doing sensible things like ringing up the breakdown company or whatever. In something like that, it takes us 30 seconds or something to get through the curve. But when it's a very big piece of very difficult, abstract news about some problem that's going to hit us, not in the next 5 minutes, but in decades to come, and might affect our children more than it affects ourselves, and it's about this gas that you can't even see, and it's about some global thing that you have to trust a whole load of scientists about, and we've just got so much wriggle room for avoiding it and finding ways of not fully facing up to it. We find ourselves convincing ourselves that the proof that we don't have to face up to it properly is that we've been denying it and life still feels fine. And the problem is this is something that will hit us in the future. And when you run out of fuel on the motorway, that's a problem that you don't spend a long time in denial, because the reality of the situation hits you in a very, very tangible and immediate way. And we don't have the luxury of that strong feedback loop with climate change. We have to anticipate what is going to happen in decades to come. So we have to get a strong emotional response now to an uncertain risk that in a not very many decades' time, we might go over a tipping point, which might lead to a catastrophic change in the climate, maybe even a few decades on from that. And we need to care enough about that it makes us take strong action today. And that is the sort of challenge that maybe humans have never had to respond to before. You know, we're capable of galvanizing whole communities and countries into very strong action. So the old analogy, but I think it's a good one, is to say, well, what happened when the Second World War came round? This country got very strongly galvanized into all kinds of action, and we learned how to crack codes and create bombs, and we got radar working and all sorts of things in a very, very short space of time. But we understood the threat, and it was a much more tangible threat. And somehow we have the challenge for us now is, how could we understand the threat at an emotional level with the same strength that we understood the threat in the late 30s and 40s? And that's a question which I think, you know, nobody knows the answer to. Nobody knows for sure what is the answer to how can humankind wake up. Just because we don't know the answer doesn't mean there isn't one, doesn't mean we can't do it. But arguably, that is the most important burning question behind the obvious burning question.
Perhaps if we believed that Martians were changing the climate as a way to attack us, that we might be able to get behind some action, taking that level of psychology into account.
Well, we wriggle around with all sorts of... The trouble with anything uncertain, you know, the human mind wriggles away from bad news as hard as it can. And the trouble with abstractions and uncertainties is they give you so much wriggle room. And we need to find a way of not getting derailed by that.
Well, of course, even if you were someone who dismissed the threat of climate change, basically that, yes, the climate changes, but it's not caused by human activity, unless you're then a believer also in abiotic oil, for example, and this just for people who don't know, it's this theory that oil within the earth actually generates itself, you know, constantly, it's renewing itself. You'd have to be a believer in that. If you're not, then there's still the issue of the supply of fossil fuels, you know, because you pointed out, of course, we can't afford to burn them for environmental reasons, but there's still the other big issue, which, well, yeah, but they're limited. So if they had no environmental impact, they'd still run out at some point. And that is also a massive issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think colleagues of mine have just written a book about the impact of the scarcity of oil. And we've had a bit of a debate about, you know, is the problem one of scarcity or one of abundance? In terms of fossil fuel, the problem is one of abundance. There's no doubt about it. There's too much of the stuff, and we need to have the discipline to voluntarily leave it in the ground. If you take the question of oil specifically, and you take the view that oil is a very particular kind of fossil fuel that has got applications that coal will never have. So, for example, we don't think foreseeably that you're going to be able to get the energy from coal and use it to power aeroplanes. To date, we haven't really cracked how to use coal to power cars. But the electric car solves that one. If you take the view that oil's not particularly fundamentally all that special amongst fossil fuels, then the problem is definitely only one of abundance. And the idea of running out is cuckoo land. But if you take the view that oil is a very special fossil fuel and that we absolutely need to be able to burn oil to power our cars and planes, then it's possible that you could put together an argument for some sort of scarcity problem with oil at the same time as a problem of abundance of the other fossil fuels. In the end, I don't think I'd go a long way with that argument because there's too much in the tar sands and we're discovering too much of it all the time and we're getting better and better at using, in the end, finding ways of doing with coal what we used to only be able to do with oil, such as drive cars. And there's always biofuels which create a hideous problem for the food system. But for all those reasons, I don't think the scarcity problem is the big deal. The problem is abundance.
I think that the debt-based monetary system that most of the world operates under is a problem here in a couple of ways. One, because it demands perpetual growth, and we're seeing all the problems with that model since the crash of 2007-08. But also the attempts to address the problems stemming from that. The focus is, in many ways, is shifted away from climate change. It's off a lot of people's agendas because of what's going on with banking.
Yes, I think that's right. So one of the dilemmas that, for example, Tim Jackson is wrestling with is how can you have a stable economic system that doesn't have growth? Because the whole way that it's wired up at the moment is, as you say, stems from the idea that businesses get in debt and the way that they get out, the way that they manage themselves is to grow their way out of debt and because debt needs servicing and so on. But I think it's an interesting idea that if you were able to do away with the idea of interest on loans, for example, if you could do away with that completely, then that whole idea of debt feeding the need for growth might go. But that's a big reinvention of the economic system. And that's another one of those questions which we ask and we explore in the book, but we don't have, in the end, the final answer to, is how much of the way that we do economics is fundamentally unfit for purpose. Some people say, you've got to have growth. You've got to have a growth-based economy. Nothing else will work, and only people who wear sandals and smoke roll-ups will ever contemplate anything different. And other people will say that economic growth is fundamentally unhelpful. To have an economic model which needs to have growth in all societies is fundamentally unhelpful, and we've got to move away from it. And I think one conclusion we come to is that economic growth, at least in developed countries, is overvalued. We put too much importance on it. We should be asking other questions that are much more important than the one of economic growth. And we've got locked into some kind of very rigid thinking around that that we would do well to break out of. But the other conclusion we came to is that it's very unproven whether or not you could have growth in a carbon-constrained world. So there are some people saying that we've never managed to decouple economic growth from growth in emissions, and that's true. We've never been able to grow economies without growing emissions, and we're miles away from ever achieving that. At a global level, we're miles away from achieving that. It doesn't even look hopeful that we could be even moving anywhere towards that. But let's ask the question another way around. If we were to cap fossil fuels, would economic growth become possible? And our answer to that is that it probably would, actually, because at the end of the day, economic growth is just about money, and money is a human construct. And if you cap the fossil fuel, the way that value moves around the society will change. Different businesses will be the ones that grow. The link between economic growth and energy will be broken. And whilst there might be a bit of a hiccup in the economy whilst everyone gets used to a new way of working under a new constraint, we don't think it's at all proven that economic growth, for what it's worth, wouldn't be possible. In fact, we think it's probably likely. If it's what humans really wanted, we're a pretty ingenious species, we'd probably find a way.
Turning to earlier decades, we saw upheaval in the energy market, specifically in the 1970s, the oil shocks there. A lot of writers, particularly today, are looking back at that, whether they lived through that period or not, as something of a missed opportunity to do something about the fossil fuel dependency.
Climate change and fossil fuel dependency weren't on the radar with the seriousness that they are now or anything like it. And the oil crisis back then was totally unplanned. It was just a situation that we found ourselves in and we had to respond to. And so possibly it was a missed opportunity, but I guess we shouldn't beat ourselves up about it because we didn't realize that was an opportunity we needed to grasp. I think there are some interesting examples from history of times when there's been a constraint on energy use and how that's been coped with. So one example in particular, and I hesitate to say this because the country I'm about to mention is so politically loaded that the minute you mention it, everybody immediately polarizes themselves. They're either going to agree or disagree with what I'm about to say just because of the name of the country. But if you look at what happened in Cuba, they found themselves in a situation where they had to constrain their energy use. They didn't do it voluntarily. The constraint on energy use was imposed upon them, but they managed it. And what's really interesting about it is that, as far as we can tell, it didn't get in the way of well-being. You know, it didn't get in the way of life expectancy. It didn't get in the way of whatever your measures of well-being are. Having to live under the energy constraint didn't interrupt well-being. In fact, they've got pretty good life expectancy and so on. And there are lots of things about life in Cuba that, you know, that are quite good. I'm not going to, you know, describe it as some utopian perfect society. But I think it does tell us that if we did have the discipline to impose the global cap on fossil fuel, it wouldn't get in the way of how good it is to be alive.
Now, the 1970s was also a time when the issue of population came to the fore, books such as The Limits to Growth being published, yeah. You had the establishment of the Club of Rome, and even in popular culture, films like Soylent Green and Zero Population Growth, and there was very much a feeling that it was, you know, around about the year 1999 that everything was going to collapse. But the serious message behind that was being that we couldn't carry on the way we were going. And yet we have, in terms of fossil fuel use and emissions. But the population picture, although it is controversial, it will need to be addressed. It's not quite as simple as we might all think it is.
No, it's not. And population is clearly a dimension of this. The more people there are, the more we need to share the resources around. But it's an example of a curve that used to be exponential and isn't anymore. It's more like linear at the moment, and it looks as though it's going to tail off, and it looks as though it's going to come to, if all our other things stay stable and we don't suffer any environmental catastrophes or anything, it looks as though it'll top out somewhere around the 9 or 10 billion mark. It looks as though that's a story of things sort of naturally managing themselves. It looks as though when societies acquire a certain level of affluence, they get to the point where people choose not to have more than a certain number of kids. Unfortunately, the point at which people start making choices to have smaller families also turns out to be the point at which they start having really high carbon lifestyles. And the two effects kind of counterbalance each other out. So if you take a country as a whole, the point at which it stops its population growth is not the same as the point at which it stops its carbon emissions, because all that happens is the static population starts picking up the slack by growing its footprint of each person that bit faster. So the population equation is a complicated one. Again, one of the simple things you can say about it is that it looks as though it is definitely, from all perspectives, unhelpful for people who don't want to have a child to end up having one. If there are any sort of simple nuggets that it's possible to distill out of all the complexities around population, that surely has got to be one of them.
I think it's really important that we do discuss these issues and do more than that, actually try to begin to formulate positive visions for the future, because if we're going to have a future, then we want it to be as positive as possible. And I must say, I mean, I suppose in closing, there are days when I think that, or fear rather, that how we're going to handle this is that we will adapt as best we can to adversity when it's forced upon us.
Well, if we just carry on ignoring the problem, we don't know how much adversity we're going to run up against. But sooner or later, if that's our approach to all the problems that we're going to encounter as a global society that burns through resources as fast as it can without much thought, then sooner or later we're going to encounter a very big problem, even if we were to stumble through the climate change one okay. So we've got to find a way of managing our impacts. I think that's as clear as daylight. But to frame it up as an inevitable doom and gloom thing is, I think we can do a bit better than that. I think if we really play our cards right, and I think if we're far-sighted enough and we've got enough vision, and I don't think enough positive vision, I think you're right, not enough positive visioning happens around this. But if we really think a bit inventively about all this, we are pursuing an opportunity agenda just as much as we're heading off a threat.
Well, Mike, once again, the book, The Burning Question, which is co-authored with Duncan Clark, now that's widely available, all the usual outlets, as they say. And you've also got a website for that, burningquestion.info. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners about the book or your work?
Well, we, as I say, it's our attempt to get some macro perspectives out there and get some big picture thinking all in one place in an accessible book. And we think that everyone who's serious, every serious politician in the world needs to understand the issues in the book. So we're going to give a copy to every MP and peer in the next couple of months and see if we can get to the point at which everyone who's in UK politics has got no excuse for not understanding at least the macro dynamics of this.
Excellent. Well, Mike Berners-Lee, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
That was the Radio EcoShock summer edit of the Legalize Freedom podcast, this time with Mike Berners-Lee and The Burning Question. Find out more about the book at www.burningquestion.info. You may also be interested in Greg Moffat's interview with controversial Deep Green author Paul Kingsnorth. It's called The Myth of Progress. Find it all at Greg's LegalizeFreedom.com website. Be sure to use the British spelling of legalize with an S. There is a dash between legalize and freedom. Or grab that link, legalizefreedom.com, from my own show blog at ecoshock.info. It's all there, ecoshock.info. Maybe it is holiday time, but the atmosphere keeps on changing, dragging the climate to places humans have never experienced. Join us for the ride at Radio EcoShock, and feel free to support our program at the website, ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening and for warming up to the idea of a big, big social change. I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock.